Don't come asking my reason. But, Mr. Reardon, we cannot let a refusal to obey the law pass unnoticed. What do you expect us to do? Whatever you wish. But this is totally unprecedented. Nobody has ever refused to sell an essential commodity to the government. As a matter of fact, the law does not permit you to refuse to sell your metal to any consumer, let alone the government. Well, why don't you arrest me, then? Mr. Reardon, this is an amicable discussion. Why speak of such things as arrests? Isn't that your ultimate argument against me? Why bring it up? Isn't it implied in every sentence of this discussion? Why name it? Why not? There was no answer. Are you trying to hide from me the fact that if it weren't for that trump card of yours, I wouldn't have allowed you to enter this office?
But I'm not speaking of arrests.
I am.
I don't understand you, Mr. Reardon.
I'm not helping you to pretend that this is any sort of amicable discussion. It isn't. Now do what you please about it. There was a strange look on the man's face, bewilderment, as if he had no conception of the issue confronting him, and fear, as if he had always had full knowledge of it, and had lived in dread of exposure. Reardon felt a strange excitement. He felt as if he were about to grasp something he had never understood, as if he were on the trail of some discovery still too distant to know, except that it had the most immense importance he had ever glimpsed.
"Mr. Reardon," said the man, "the government needs your metal. You have to sell it to us, because surely you realize that the government's plans cannot be held up by the matter of your consent."
"A sale," said Reardon slowly, "requires the seller's consent." He got up and walked to the window. "I'll tell you what you can do." He pointed to the siding where ingots of Reardon metal were being loaded onto freight cars. "There's Reardon metal. Drive down there with your trucks, like any other looter, but without his risk, because I won't shoot you, as you know I can't. Take as much of the metal as you wish and go. Don't try to send me payment. I won't accept it. Don't print out a check to me. It won't be cashed. If you want that metal, you have the guns to seize it. Go ahead."
"Good God, Mr. Reardon, what would the public think?"
It was an instinctive, involuntary cry. The muscles of Reardon's face moved briefly in a soundless laughter. Both of them had understood the implications of that cry. Reardon said evenly, in the grave, unstrained tone of finality, "You need my help to make it look like a sale, like a safe, just, moral transaction. I will not help you." The man did not argue. He rose to leave. He said only,
"You will regret the stand you've taken, Mr. Reardon."
"I don't think so," said Reardon.
He knew that the incident was not ended. He knew also that the secrecy of Project X was not the main reason why these people feared to make the issue public. He knew that he felt an odd, joyous, light-hearted self-confidence. He knew that these were the right steps down the trail he had glimpsed.
Dagny lay stretched in an armchair of her living room, her eyes closed. This day had been hard, but she knew that she would see Hank Reardon tonight. The thought of it was like a lever lifting the weight of hours of senseless ugliness away from her. She lay still, content to rest with the single purpose of waiting quietly for the sound of the key in the lock. He had not telephoned her, but she had heard that he was in New York today for a conference with producers of copper, and he never left the city till next morning, nor spent a night in New York that was not hers. She liked to wait for him. She needed a span of time as a bridge between her days and his nights. The hours ahead, like all her nights with him, would be added, she thought, to that savings account of one's life where moments of time are stored in the pride of having been lived. The only pride of her workday was not that it had been lived, but that it had been survived. It was wrong, she thought. It was viciously wrong that one should ever be forced to say that about any hour of one's life. But she could not think of it now. She was thinking of him, of the struggle she had watched through the months behind them, his struggle for deliverance. She had known that she could help him win, but must help him in every way except in words. She thought of the evening last winter when he came in,
took a small package from his pocket and held it out to her, saying, "I want you to have it." She opened it and stared in incredulous bewilderment at a pendant made of a single pear-shaped ruby that spurted a violent fire on the white satin of the jeweler's box. It was a famous stone, which only a dozen men in the world could properly afford to purchase. He was not one of them.
"Hank, why?"
"No special reason. I just wanted to see you wear it."
"Oh, no, not a thing of this kind. Why waste it? I go so rarely to occasions where one has to dress. When would I ever wear it?"
He looked at her, his glance moving slowly from her legs to her face. "I'll show you," he said. He led her to the bedroom. He took off her clothes, without a word, in the manner of an owner undressing a person whose consent is not required. He clasped the pendant on her shoulders. She stood naked, the stone between her breasts, like a sparkling drop of blood. "Do you think a man should give jewelry to his mistress for any purpose but his own pleasure?" he asked. "This is the way I want you to wear it, only for me. I like to look at it. It's beautiful." She laughed. It was a soft, low, breathless sound. She could not speak or move, only nod silently in acceptance and obedience. She nodded several times, her hair swaying with the wide, circular movement of her head, then hanging still as she kept her head bowed to him. She dropped down on the bed. She lay stretched lazily, her head thrown back, her arms at her sides, palms pressed to the rough texture of the bedspread, one leg bent, the long line of the other extended across the dark blue linen of the spread, the stone glowing like a wound in the semi-darkness, throwing a star of rays against her skin. Her eyes were half closed in the mocking, conscious triumph of being admired, but her mouth was half open in helpless, begging expectation. He stood across the room looking at her flat stomach drawn in as her breath was drawn, at the sensitive body of a sensitive consciousness. He said, his voice low, intent, and oddly quiet, "Dagny, if some artist painted you as you are now, men would come to look at the painting to experience a moment that nothing could give them in their own lives. They would call it great art. They would not know the nature of what they felt, but the painting would show them everything. Even that you're not some classical Venus, but the vice president of a railroad, because that's part of it. Even what I am, because that's part of it too, Dagny. They'd feel it and go away and sleep with the first barmaid in sight, and they'd never try to reach what they had felt. I wouldn't want to seek it from a painting. I'd want it real. I'd take no pride in any hopeless longing. I wouldn't hold a stillborn aspiration. I'd want to have it, to make it, to live it. Do you understand?" "Oh, yes, Hank, I understand," she said. "Do you, my darling? Do you understand it fully?" she thought, but did not say it aloud. On the evening of a blizzard, she came home to find an enormous spread of tropical flowers standing in her living room against the dark glass of windows battered by snowflakes. They were stems of Hawaiian torch ginger, 3 feet tall. Their large heads were cones of petals that had the sensual texture of soft leather and the color of blood. "I saw them in a florist's window," he told her when he came that night. "I liked seeing them through a blizzard. But there's nothing as wasted as an object in a public window." She began to find flowers in her apartment at unpredictable times, flowers sent without a card, but with the signature of the sender, in their fantastic shapes, in the violent colors, in the extravagant cost. He brought her a gold necklace made of small hinged squares that formed a spread of solid gold to cover her neck and shoulders like the collar of a knight's armor. "Wear it with a black dress," he ordered. He brought her a set of glasses that were tall, slender blocks of square-cut crystal made by a famous jeweler. She watched the way he held one of the glasses when she served him a drink, as if the touch of the texture under his fingers, the taste of the drink, and the sight of her face were the single form of an indivisible moment of enjoyment. "I used to see things I liked," he said, "but I never bought them. There didn't seem to be much meaning in it. There is now."
He telephoned her at the office one winter morning and said, not in the tone of an invitation, but in the tone of an executive's order, "We're going to have dinner together tonight. I want you to dress. Do you have any sort of blue evening gown? Wear it." The dress she wore was a slender tunic of dusty blue that gave her a look of unprotected simplicity, the look of a statue in the blue shadows of a garden under the summer sun. What he brought and put over her shoulders was a cape of blue fox that swallowed her from the curve of her chin to the tips of her sandals. "Hank, that's preposterous," she laughed. "It's not my kind of thing." "No?" he asked, drawing her to a mirror. The huge blanket of fur made her look like a child, bundled for a snowstorm. The luxurious texture transformed the innocence of the awkward bundle into the elegance of a perversely intentional contrast, into a look of stressed sensuality. The fur was a soft brown, dimmed by an aura of blue that could not be seen, only felt, like an enveloping mist, like a suggestion of color grasped, not by one's eyes, but by one's hands, as if one felt without contact the sensation of sinking one's palms into the fur's softness. The cape left nothing to be seen of her except the brown of her hair, the blue-gray of her eyes, the shape of her mouth. She turned to him, her smile startled and helpless.
I didn't know it would look like that."
"I did." She sat beside him in his car as he drove through the dark streets of the city. A sparkling net of snow flashed into sight once in a while when they went past the lights on the corners. She did not ask where they were going. She sat low in the seat, leaning back, looking up at the snowflakes. The fur cape was wrapped tightly about her. Within it, her dress felt as light as a nightgown, and the feel of the cape was like an embrace. She looked at the angular tiers of lights rising through the snowy curtain, and, glancing at him, at the grip of his gloved hands on the wheel, at the austere, fastidious elegance of the figure in black overcoat and white muffler, she thought that he belonged in a great city, among polished sidewalks and sculptured stone. The car went down into a tunnel, streaked through an echoing tube of tile under the river, and rose to the coils of an elevated highway under an open black sky. The lights were below them now, spread in flat miles of bluish windows, of smokestacks, slanting cranes, red gusts of fire, and long dim rays silhouetting the contorted shapes of an industrial district. She thought that she had seen him once at his mills, with smudges of soot on his forehead, dressed in acid-eaten overalls. He had worn them as naturally well as he wore his formal clothes. He belonged here, too, she thought, looking down at the flats of New Jersey, among the cranes, the fires, and the grinding clatter of gears. When they sped down a dark road through an empty countryside, with the strands of snow glittering across their headlights, she remembered how he had looked in the summer of their vacation, dressed in slacks, stretched on the ground of a lonely ravine with the grass under his body and the sun on his bare arms. He belonged in the countryside, she thought. He belonged everywhere. He was a man who belonged on earth. And then she thought of the words which were more exact. He was a man to whom the earth belonged, the man at home on earth and in control. Why, then, she wondered, should he have had to carry a burden of tragedy which, in silent endurance, he had accepted so completely that he had barely known he carried it? She knew part of the answer. She felt as if the whole answer were close, and she would grasp it on some approaching day. But she did not want to think of it now, because they were moving away from the burdens, because within the space of a speeding car they held the stillness of full happiness. She moved her head imperceptibly to let it touch his shoulder for a moment. The car left the highway and turned toward the lighted squares of distant windows that hung above the snow beyond a grillwork of bare branches. Then, in a soft, dim light, they sat at a table by a window facing darkness and trees. The inn stood on a knoll in the woods. It had the luxury of high cost and privacy, and an air of beautiful taste, suggesting that it had not been discovered by those who sought high cost and notice. She was barely aware of the dining room. It blended away into a sense of superlative comfort, and the only ornament that caught her attention was the glitter of iced branches beyond the glass of the window. She sat looking out,
the blue fur half slipping off her naked arms and shoulders. He watched her through narrowed eyes with the satisfaction of a man studying his own workmanship.
"I like giving things to you," he said, "because you don't need them."
"No."
"And it's not that I want you to have them. I want you to have them from me."
"That is the way I do need them, Hank. From you."
"Do you understand that it's nothing but vicious self-indulgence on my part? I'm not doing it for your pleasure, but for mine."
"Hank!"
The cry was involuntary. It held amusement, despair, indignation, and pity.
"If you'd given me those things just for my pleasure, not yours, I would have thrown them in your face."
"Yes. Yes, then you would, and should."
"Did you call it your vicious self-indulgence?"
"That's what they call it."
"Oh, yes, that's what they call it. What do you call it, Hank?"
"I don't know," he said indifferently, and went on intently. "I know only that if it's vicious, then let me be damned for it, but that's what I want to do more than anything else on earth." She did not answer. She sat looking straight at him with a faint smile, as if asking him to listen to the meaning of his own words.
"I've always wanted to enjoy my wealth," he said. "I didn't know how to do it. I didn't even have time to know how much I wanted to. But I knew that all the steel I poured came back to me as liquid gold, and the gold was meant to harden into any shape I wished. And it was I who had to enjoy it. Only I couldn't. I couldn't find any purpose for it. I found it now. It's I who produced that wealth, and it's I who am going to let it buy for me every kind of pleasure I want, including the pleasure of seeing how much I'm able to pay for, including the preposterous feat of turning you into a luxury object."
"But I'm a luxury object that you've paid for long ago," she said. She was not smiling.
"How?"
"By means of the same values with which you paid for your mills." She did not know whether he understood it with that full luminous finality which is a thought named in words, but she knew that what he felt in that moment was understanding. She saw the relaxation of an invisible smile in his eyes.
"I've never despised luxury," he said. "Yet I've always despised those who enjoyed it. I looked at what they called their pleasures, and it seemed so miserably senseless to me, after what I felt at the mills. I used to watch steel being poured, tons of liquid steel running as I wanted it to, where I wanted it. And then I'd go to a banquet, and I'd see people who sat trembling in awe before their own gold dishes and lace tablecloths, as if their dining room were the master, and they were just objects serving it, objects created by their diamond shirt studs and necklaces, not the other way around. Then I'd run to the side of the first slag heap I could find, and they'd say that I didn't know how to enjoy life, because I cared for nothing but business."
He looked at the dim sculptured beauty of the room, and at the people who sat at the tables. They sat in a manner of self-conscious display, as if the enormous cost of their clothes and the enormous care of their grooming should have fused into splendor, but didn't. Their faces had a look of rancorous anxiety.
"Dagny, look at those people. They're supposed to be the playboys of life, the amusement seekers and luxury lovers. They sit there waiting for this place to give them meaning, not the other way around. But they're always shown to us as the enjoyers of material pleasures. And then we're taught that enjoyment of material pleasures is evil."
"Enjoyment? Are they enjoying it? Isn't there some sort of perversion in what we're taught, some error that's vicious and very important?"
"Yes, Hank. Very vicious and very, very important.
They are the playboys, while we're just tradesmen, you and I. Do you realize that we're much more capable of enjoying this place than they can ever hope to be?"
"Yes,"
he said slowly in the tone of a quotation.
"Why have we left it all to fools? It should have been ours."
She looked at him, startled. He smiled.
"I remember every word you said to me at that party. I didn't answer you then because the only answer I had, the only thing your words meant to me, was an answer that you would hate me for, I thought. It was that I wanted you."
He looked at her.
"Dagny, you didn't intend it then. But what you were saying was that you wanted to sleep with me, wasn't it?
Yes, Hank, of course.
He held her eyes, then looked away. They were silent for a long time. He glanced at the soft twilight around them, then at the sparkle of two wine glasses on their table.
Dagny, in my youth, when I was working in the ore mines in Minnesota, I thought that I wanted to reach an evening like this. No, that was not what I was working for, and I didn't think of it often. But once in a while, on a winter night, when the stars were out and it was very cold, when I was tired because I'd worked two shifts and wanted nothing on earth except to lie down and fall asleep right there on the mine ledge, I thought that someday I would sit in a place like this where one drink of wine would cost more than my day's wages, and I would have earned the price of every minute of it, and of every drop, and of every flower on the table, and I would sit there for no purpose but my own amusement.
She asked, smiling, "With your mistress?" She saw the shot of pain in his eyes and wished desperately that she had not said it.
"With
a woman," he answered. She knew the word he had not pronounced. He went on, his voice soft and steady. "When I became rich and saw what the rich did for their amusement, I thought that the place I had imagined did not exist. I had not even imagined it too clearly. I did not know what it would be like, only what I would feel. I gave up expecting it years ago. But I feel it tonight." He raised his glass, looking at her.
"Hank, I'd give up anything I've ever had in my life except my being a luxury object of your amusement."
He saw her hand trembling as she held her glass. He said evenly,
"I know it, dearest."
She sat shocked and still. He had never used that word before. He threw his head back and smiled the most brilliantly gay smile she had ever seen on his face.
"Your first moment of weakness, Dagny," he said.
She laughed and shook her head. He stretched his arm across the table and closed his hand over her naked shoulder, as if giving her an instant's support. Laughing softly, and as if by accident, she let her mouth brush against his fingers. It kept her face down for the one moment when he could have seen the brilliance of her eyes was tears. When she looked up at him, her smile matched his, and the rest of the evening was their celebration for all his years since the nights on the mine ledges, for all her years since the night of her first ball when, in desolate longing for an uncaptured vision of gaiety, she had wondered about the people who expected the lights and the flowers to make them brilliant.
"Isn't there, in what we're taught, some error that's vicious and very important?"
She thought of his words as she lay in an armchair of her living room on a dismal evening of spring, waiting for him to come.
"Just a little farther, my darling," she thought. "Look a little farther, and you'll be free of that error, and of all the wasted pain you never should have had to carry."
But she felt that she, too, had not seen the whole of the distance, and she wondered what were the steps left for her to discover. Walking through the darkness of the streets on his way to her apartment, Reardon kept his hands in his coat pockets and his arms pressed to his sides, because he felt that he did not want to touch anything or brush against anyone. He had never experienced it before. The sense of revulsion that was not aroused by any particular object, but seemed to flood everything around him, making the city seem sodden. He could understand disgust for any one thing, and he could fight that thing with the healthy indignation of knowing that it did not belong in the world. But this was new to him, this feeling that the world was a loathsome place where he did not want to belong. He had held a conference with the producers of copper, who had just been garroted by a set of directives that would put them out of existence in another year. He had had no advice to give them, no solution to offer. His ingenuity, which had made him famous as the man who would always find a way to keep production going, had not been able to discover a way to save them. But they had all known that there was no way. Ingenuity was a virtue of the mind, and in the issue confronting them, the mind had been discarded as irrelevant long ago. "It's a deal between the boys in Washington and the importers of copper," one of the men had said. "Mainly Dunconia copper." This was only a small, extraneous stab of pain, he thought, a feeling of disappointment in an expectation he had never had the right to expect. He should have known that this was just what a man like Francisco d'Anconia would do, and he wondered angrily why he felt as if a bright, brief flame had died somewhere in a lightless world. He did not know whether the impossibility of acting had given him this sense of loathing, or whether the loathing had made him lose the desire to act. It's both, he thought. A desire presupposes the possibility of action to achieve it. Action presupposes a goal which is worth achieving. If the only goal possible was to wheedle a precarious moment's favor from men who held guns, then neither action nor desire could exist any longer. Then could life? He asked himself indifferently. Life, he thought, had been defined as motion. Man's life was purposeful motion. What was the state of a being to whom purpose and motion were denied? A being held in chains, but left to breathe and to see all the magnificence of the possibilities he could have reached. Left to scream, why? And to be shown the muzzle of a gun as sole explanation. He shrugged, walking on. He did not care even to find an answer. He observed indifferently the devastation wrought by his own indifference. No matter how hard a struggle he had lived through in the past, he had never reached the ultimate ugliness of abandoning the will to act. In moments of suffering, he had never let pain win its one permanent victory. He had never allowed it to make him lose the desire for joy. He had never doubted the nature of the world or man's greatness as its motive power and its core. Years ago, he had wondered with contemptuous incredulity about the fanatical sects that appeared among men in the dark corners of history. The sects who believed that man was trapped in a malevolent universe ruled by evil for the sole purpose of his torture. Tonight he knew what their vision of the world and their feel of it had been. If what he now saw around him was the world in which he lived, then he did not want to touch any part of it. He did not want to fight it. He was an outsider, with nothing at stake and no concern for remaining alive much longer. Dagny and his wish to see her were the only exception left to him. The wish remained. But in a sudden shock he realized that he felt no desire to sleep with her tonight. That desire which had never given him a moment's rest, which had been growing, feeding on its own satisfaction, was wiped out. It was an odd impotence, neither of his mind nor of his body. He felt as passionately as he had ever felt it, that she was the most desirable woman on earth. But what came from it was only a desire to desire her, a wish to feel, not a feeling. The sense of numbness seemed impersonal, as if its root were neither in him nor in her, as if it were the act of sex that now belonged to a realm which he had left. Don't get up. Stay there. It's so obvious that you've been waiting for me that I want to look at it longer. He said it from the doorway of her apartment, seeing her stretched in an armchair, seeing the eager little jolt that threw her shoulders forward as she was about to rise. He was smiling. He noted, as if some part of him were watching his reactions with detached curiosity, that his smile and his sudden sense of gaiety were real. He grasped a feeling that he had always experienced, but never identified because it had always been absolute and immediate, a feeling that forbade him ever to face her in pain. It was much more than the pride of wishing to conceal his suffering. It was the feeling that suffering must not be granted recognition in her presence, that no form of claim between them should ever be motivated by pain and aimed at pity. It was not pity that he brought here or came here to find. "Do you still need proof that I'm always waiting for you?" she asked, leaning obediently back in her chair. Her voice was neither tender nor pleading, but bright and mocking.